Let's restart. What I want to do now, a reading assignment, and that is chapter 3, which is on scanning, which I'll be getting to today, but by no means completing. I just wanted to go back again through the various phases and, in fact, just do a little better job on the final executable code part of it. So recall last time we just established an overall terminology in the overall phases of compiling. So we started with the example of a simple program, which is nothing more or less than a sequence of characters in a file. The fact that files are typically broken up into lines is really irrelevant, and as far as the scanner is concerned, an entire program on one line would be a possibility. Usually that's not the case because programs are meant to be human readable. But as far as we're concerned, there are simply characters in the character sequence in a file, some number of them. The scanner, which we'll start in today, has the job of breaking up individual character sequences into the words of the language. These would be things like identifiers, literals, comments, quoted strings, delimiters, like commas and semicolons and parens. And toward the middle of the bottom of the page, I illustrate what the scanner has done by changing colors. It's automatically, via our definition, recognized that A is an identifier, equal is the assignment operator, BB as one identifier composed of two letters is an identifier, plus is an operator, ABS is an identifier that happens to be the name of a method or function, a paren, C, which is an identifier, minus, which is an operator, 7, which is an integer literal. Literal means you literally have the value there. So think of it as an integer number, but number sounds a little too crude, so people use literals. A closed paren and a semicolon. We, of course, don't see it that way inside the scanner, or inside the compiler. We see it as a sequence of tokens that are fed one by one from the scanner into the parser. So it sees, oh, I'm an identifier, and the subscript represents the fact that I carry the information that it's an identifier named A, an assignment, identifier named B, plus identifier named ABS, a left paren, identifier named C, and then continuing next line, minus, integer literal with the numeric value 7, right paren, and semicolon. Those are then fed into a parser, which verifies that the input is in fact valid and builds an AST. And I apologize, my plus somehow got shifted down a little bit. So bear with me on that. You know, that should be up a little neater and all that. So the tree notices this is in fact an assignment. The identifier is the left-hand side. The right-hand side is an expression rooted by plus, which is adding the value of BB and a call. A call is to an identifier ABS, and its parameter is the difference between identifier C and an integer literal. And again, the 7 somehow got lost. That should be there. Make a note if it bothers you. What happened to the parens and semicolon? They weren't needed in the tree. The tree structure gives us some of that information. We then analyze the tree for semantic correctness. That is, is it not only valid in terms of the sequencing, but also in terms of what we're asking it to do? It's rather much like English. Last time I mentioned that there are some things that look like valid English but are incomprehensible. And the thing that always comes to my mind is the poem Jabberwocky by, I guess, Lewis Carroll. Now, it almost looks like it's real English, and just when you're starting to think you'd understand it, either you don't know what the words are or they don't really quite make sense or whatever. You can imagine a program like that, but unlike English, we have to actually execute it. So in this case, we've analyzed the definitions and, in this case, in red, added information and saying this is all involving integers. This is the last step to what I really wanted to show you, which is code generation. And let me switch so I can write on this to a transcription of this. So this is actually JVM code, and what bothered people last time is how this, as executable code, really ran. Now, the key here is that we have something called an operand stack. We don't use registers because the JVM wants to run on a variety of machines, some of which have many registers, other of which have few. Didn't want to tie it down to a fixed number of registers. So we have a stack, ALA 367, that contains operand values. They typically might be numbers, but they also might be the strings or booleans or something else. So imagine as we execute, we have a stack. And the stack has a bottom and a top, and the top, of course, is where we put things in. Many instructions will access the stack, either putting data in or taking data out. So an integer load says, go into, this is variable number, so go into variable number 3. So we just gave variables numbers the way ball players get numbers on their back. So we had A, B, B, and C. So those had 3 numbers, 1, 2, and 3. Turns out, in this case, variable 3 got number 3. So he's BB. So it says, find the value BB and push it on this operand stack. So I'm writing down BB, but really what is in there is the numeric value stored in the memory location that BB names, which is variable number 3. It then says load variable number 2, which is C, and put it on the stack. And like stacks, things can grow and you can add things and remove things. So it then says load constant 7, that's the literal 7, and put that on the stack. So I have some numbers sitting on the stack that will be used in future. The next thing says do an integer subtraction. Well, where do I get my operands from? I get them from the stack, and particularly since operation subtraction is binary, I take the top two operands. So it says take C and 7, 7 being the top guy is the right operand, C being the one underneath it is the left operand, and actually does a computation replacing these two guys with the actual numeric value of C minus 7. I don't know what that is, so I'm writing it down symbolically, but it would actually be a number. It then says invoke static. Remember we were talking about static a moment ago. Static in this case means a static method. That is a method that does not exist inside of a class, a class instance, but it exists only inside of a class. Because this thing is so long, I couldn't fit it on one line, but it's actually in a library. And the cool thing about JVM is I can actually name where in the library it is because Java is well standardized. And in this case, slashes represent dots. It uses dots for other purposes. So it says go into java.lang.math and find a method called ABS. Turns out there's many of them, or at least several, because this is overloaded. And give me the one that takes one parameter whose type is I being integer, and whose result value is I. So find me the value of ABS that takes an integer and returns an integer. And where do you suppose it finds that? On the operand stack. So it takes the value of C minus 7 as a number, computes the absolute value, which means it's either unchanged or the sign is flipped, and returns the numeric value of ABS of C minus 7. That's sitting on the stack. It then says, let's do an add, an integer add. Again, that's binary. So the right operand is the numeric value of ABS of C minus 7, and the other one is the numeric value of B. It adds those, so the operands get popped off, and I have the numeric value of BB plus ABS of C minus 7 as a number. And the final thing says, take what's sitting on top of the stack and store it into variable number 1, which is A. So the net effect is to take all this guy and put it into A. And that's very much how our compiler will operate. It'll take all these statements we have in our language and break them down into little steps, like load a variable, subtract a variable, store a variable, compare one variable against another, do a conditional branch, do a subroutine call, whatever. And the net effect will be to do a computation. This is very similar to what okay, we're back again. So you've heard about a three-dog night. This is a two battery, a lecture, I guess. If we get to three, then I know I'm really overstepping my time. So anyway, I was saying, so this is really very similar to what a real computer would do. It uses registers, and in fact, I won't talk about it today, but in future I will. There's a very clever way of mapping these stack locations to registers. So if I wanted to execute this on a machine that had registers, like, for example, an x86 or something else, there's a way of doing it. And again, I'd have to show you a little bit about it, but it is every bit as efficient. So the mere fact we don't show you the registers does not mean they're not being used. It's simply it's being hidden in the JVM, and that way we don't have to worry about, does my machine have enough number of registers? It doesn't have to. All it has to do is implement this virtual machine architecture, and we're okay. So the strength of Java is it doesn't belong to any one particular architecture, so therefore it can be shared by everyone. So let's go back. Oops. There we go. So as I promised you a while ago, we're now going to go to symbol tables and scoping, which is something you need for your particular project. This is coming out a little... What in the world? What? This is crazy because I stepped through the lecture earlier today and it came through fine. Well, let me tell you what I should have said. So programming languages use scopes to limit the range in which an identifier is active. Somehow it's got the names moved. So a scope may be defined only once, although when you printed these out, anybody print these out? Did they come out cleanly on your notes? Golly, this machine loves me or something. I don't know, in the preview it's screwed up too. Well, I think this is only the one. I have no idea why it is, but if it printed out cleanly on yours and mine. Okay. So what was saying, so let me just go back to paper, which is always a good situation. So essentially, remember, we're going to take a programming language that originally had a single scope. In the old days, for very first programming languages, there was essentially the notion that when you declared an identifier, like int A, or bool B, it extended towards the entire length of a program. Now, that kind of raises an issue and something you may have noticed and something that language designers have been trying to improve languages at. Namely, when we took 367, we did the dreaded big O notation. Now, when we take programming, what should be the big O for programming? That is, as my programs get bigger and bigger, what is the expected execution time, not execution time, but definition time to write a program? This is not a minor thing. This is a very major thing because is it the case that as my program doubles, that the programming effort is linear? That'd be cool if it is, because that means that big projects aren't really all that much harder. It simply needs additional programming staff. In fact, there used to be an old joke about it, about how that was, that once upon a time, IBM was the big programming, everything was IBM. In fact, one student's mom worked for IBM when IBM ruled the world, and not so anymore. And there was an old joke that a metric of productivity was something called, in those days, the man year. I don't want to insult women, so we'll call it a person year. But that would be all the work one person would do in a year. So there'd be an old joke, what's a man year or a person year at IBM? And the answer would be 730 IBMers being assigned a project after lunch. Now, what's 730? 365 times 2. So assuming, so you're giving an afternoon and you're taking 365 people doing the afternoon, 730 people spending an afternoon would be, in some metrics, equal to a person year. If things were linear. But do you think that would have really ever worked? Would it work here? If you had a rush job and you said, no, give me 1,000 people and everybody's going to have to work this afternoon and we'll have 1,000 half days worth of effort in the problem. And the answer is no. And in fact, one argument could be that when you write programs down, you don't know how bad it could be. But here's an argument that it probably in the old style ought to be considered at least N squared. And here's the argument, and it's very similar to what we did in 367 when it seemed kind of very abstract. It's that suppose I add a line right here, just my little contribution for the day. So A equals B plus C. Before I can figure out is this line valid and what does it do, I may have to look at the entire text of the program to find A, to find B, to find all the places where A and B and C, for that matter, are used and how they interact. So the bigger the program gets, the more possibility I have of interaction. Now, again, this is kind of crude, but you can see that's kind of the argument we did when we had an N-squared algorithm. For some of the sorts we did, if I wanted to insert something, I might have to look at all the other data in an array to figure out where to put it. In this case, if I'm, say I'm trying to figure out where to put this line, I may have to look at all the other lines of code to decide whether or not this is the proper spot. And as it gets bigger and bigger, it gets worse and worse. And that's kind of, and it could even be worse than that, but you can see why. And of course, if we had n squared fact, that's bad. It means if a program gets 10 times bigger, it's 100 times more costly to do. And there are, in fact, maybe limits to how far we can scale something up. So the question is, how does scoping come into play? And the answer is, if I happen to have something where I create a scope, and I'll use this int, I have int A, B, C. Now, again, this little thing isn't doing a heck of a lot. Maybe I'll do a print here. Something like that. Now I have scoping. Now is that argument I made earlier about the fact that I have to be careful about where I put this in the program and examine all the other lines, maybe thousands of them, to figure out how it interacts. Is that argument still valid? And the answer is no. The cool thing about scoping is it limited the range of effect. So that means that I can go to my office and get this little bit of code right, and almost any place where I put it in the program, assuming I got to do initialization and all that, it's not totally trivial, it's not going to, for example, destroy anybody else named A because they have a local variable. So the argument is adding scoping is a way of allowing people to limit the effect of what they're doing, and also indirectly to verify that the little bit of program they have is valid in context, independent of what all their other neighbors are doing. So you may have somebody else writing the program that loves A, B, and C. That's their favorite variables. They use it all over the place, and yet you're still not stepping on their toes. So that's sort of the human factors argument about why scoping is important. Let's see if we can now go back and get a display that is more readable. Oops, come on, try it again. Okay. So one of the things we haven't talked about in declarations, and languages vary, is when I make a declaration, is it something that, or I should say when I have a use, is it something that is respect to a declaration always already in place, or is it something that may occur in future? So it turns out, let me illustrate the difference of this and explain why languages have evolved the way they have. So that means if I have something like A equals B plus 1, something very simple. If I'm going to understand what A's value is going to be, I have to understand what B's value is, and I say, where is B? Now, many languages have a rule that you may not use an identifier before it's declared, which means I don't have to worry at all about that bottom part. I just have to look at stuff prior to it. So it's rather much like reading a book where all the characters are described to you before they get into being used. So if you're reading a book and it says, Henry said this, and this is the first mention of Henry, and Henry's an important character, who's Henry? Why is Henry irrelevant? So languages have a rule that sometimes you may not use an identifier before it's declared. Turns out Java uses that, for example, for local variables. There are other cases where you are allowed to use a name before it's defined, And in Java, that's in terms of fields and class names. Fields and method names. And the reason for that is, in methods, you have to be able to mention a method before it's used. Otherwise, we can't have mutual recursion. It's possible, for example, to have a method like this. And this equals so you're saying I want to have A and it returns B of I, and I could also have turns out this is not a particularly good definition because we're going to figure out what it does. But it's possible to have one method recursively talk about another one and call back and forth. So A is defined in terms of B, B is defined in terms of A. Now, this is not a particularly good example because I just did it off the top of my head. We will show in future about much more useful cases. But if I didn't allow forward referencing, I could never have anything at all of this flavor. So question is, now down here I would say print A of 10. Now, I said this wasn't a particularly good definition because what's going to happen in this particular case? I'm going to call A of 10. It's going to say, well, let's call B of 10. B is say, well, let's call A of 10. And you can see I've got a circularity of sort where A is in terms of B and B in terms of A. So this isn't a great example, and certainly there are more useful reasons. But even the ability to have this sort of indirect recursion is something that mitigates for forward references. So when we're talking about symbol tables and symbols, we'll have to be very careful about what language features are allowed to have forward references and which aren't, and particularly when we do a symbol table for them. So a language may or may not allow forward references. In our language, and you don't have to worry about this yet, but you will in future, there's only one place where forward references are allowed, and as you might imagine, it's what I just showed you, namely for methods. A method is allowed to call some other method before it's been defined. Otherwise, it could never have this A calls B, B calls A. And you're probably not convinced yet that it's all that terribly useful, but it turns out there are at least several applications where it is. If forward references are allowed, then you can use a name that's defined later in the scope. We'll have to talk about how the symbol table handles that. But if not, you can simply say, look at the declarations we have so far and check among those. So if your case is what you're doing in Project 1, no forward references. That means that you have to have something declared and then used. And you kind of see a flavor of that because the language, like many languages, has the declaration part come first and then the statements it uses come later. And that's sort of forcing you to put declarations early and uses later. So if forward references are not allowed, then it's visible only after its declaration. C, C++, and Java, and our language called CSX all have that flavor. And there it is. CSX, the only forward references we have are to methods. And that's because I do want to be able to have recursion between methods. In terms of symbol tables, the way this works is, the simpler of the two is no forward references. And what happens in that case, let's see the flavor of what we do. So we'd have a program that says, here's my decals. Oh, sorry. And here are my statements. And this is similar to what you're going to see in CSX and CSX Lite. So what would happen is in all the decals, what we do is we fill in the symbol table. Because remember, each declaration adds entry to the symbol table. It says, here's my name, here's my type, here's where I'm located. And then statements look up into the symbol table, look up into the symbol table. So it's a nice one-phase process. While you're in declarations, you're adding to the symbol table. While you're in statements, you're going ahead and looking them up. Now, when you get the block structure, it gets intermixed a little bit more because we'll have more than one symbol table. We'll have one for scope. But certainly in this case, what would happen is fill in the symbol table and then look it up. If we're if you're allowed to have forward references, it's not quite that simple, because in that particular case, it may be a situation where I have to see all the declarations first. So what we do in that particular case, then it says with forward references, what you would do is you'd make one pass completely through the scope. It says look for all declarations. Look and enter all declarations. So in our case, the only forward references we have in CSX are methods. So what we would do is we'd find each method header. And that's easy to do because you simply say, look for void or type, the name, and then the parentheses. And in this case, we'd have four different methods. But what we would do is we'd look for the headers, but we would not analyze the body because that's uses of the methods. So the first phase would look and enter all declarations, and then a second phase can look up declarations. Since all the declarations have been found, any use will be able to reference a declaration already in place. And we'll talk more about that when we talk about coding methods, but that's essentially the differentiation there. And let's go back to the notes. So as I said, first all declarations are gathered, then all references are resolved using the complete set of declarations in the symbol table. If forward references are disallowed, and in our language they are disallowed for project one, and in fact for all the projects except for methods, then it's even simpler. When you see a declaration, you add it into the table. When you see a use, you look it up, and you do that during one traversal through the AST. So it's a little simpler process. Block structured languages. This is that notion that I was talking about a little bit earlier, namely that as early as ALGOL 60. Now, can anybody guess what the 60 in ALGOL 60 is? That's the year it was invented. And one of the problems of this is that in the old days, they used to put the number or the year in the language. And that's cool, but after a while, the language looked more and more dated. Now, you don't have to worry about it yet, but imagine that if people had their year of birth kind of tattooed on their forehead or something, you know, situation, almost like cars. You know, I see that, you know, that's a 2003 Corvette. And I don't know, 2003 is 13 years old, so that's not so great. But Corvettes are pretty nice cars, so that's pretty good. So you could actually go ahead and tell. So languages have stopped doing that. But the uptake is that we've been worrying about scoping for 50-plus years, because the earliest languages which didn't have scoping had this problem I alluded to, namely even a tiny little change anywhere in a program might force you to look at the entire text to see what sort of effects it might have. Did it block a declaration, change a declaration, block a definition, change a value, etc.? And none of that is nice. So it started in ALGOL 60 and included C, which is roughly in the 70s, C++, which is roughly in the 80s, C#, which is in the, what do we call the zeros? The aughts, the 2000 zeros, that's roughly CSX. CSX is about the same as C#, and Java, which is, again, roughly around the 2000s. So it's a good idea that almost all major languages have carried forward, and people are even telling me, in this case, even Cache has some notion of scoping, so even there, you have some benefit. Identifiers may have a non-global scope, and making declarations local to a class or a subprogram or a block. Remember, inside methods, all the declarations inside of a method are local to the method. And as I'll tell you shortly, that turns out to be extremely advantageous in perhaps an unexpected way. Scopes may nest. That's going to be the biggest problem you have, because as scopes nest, your block-structured symbol table gets more and more subtables, one for each accessible scope. And there's no limit on that. There's no reason why the grader might not have a program that had dozens of scopes. So scope number one, scope number two, scope number three, scope number four. And the only reason I mention that is that one way to implement a block-structured symbol table is to create a list, which is treated as kind of like a stack of tables. Now, as we remember from 367, there's at least two ways of doing lists. One of them is an array list, which has the size limit in it. And if you do that, then you have to be prepared or have a class implementation that if the list length is exhausted, expands the size of the list. The alternative, the one I use because I'm too lazy to do all those details, is a linked list, which uses extra space because of the links, but has this property that it can grow indefinitely up to the limits of memory, which are very generous. So depending on which way you do a list of tables, be aware of the fact that there's, in the language, no fixed reason that the number of scopes would be limited, except common sense. No sane person would probably have 1,000 scopes, but it's not to say the TA might not sit down at a text editor and create one just to see what happens. Certainly to a computer, 1,000 scopes is no big deal, but it might be to your implementation if you use an array list of size 100, which sounds generous, but who knows? So there's that issue. So scopes can nest up to any limit that the user cares to have. The rule is you go through scopes from the innermost to the outermost. The innermost scope that has a definition corresponding to your use is the one that counts. So the important point there is inner scopes hide access to outer scopes. And that means that you can use safely a definition in inner scope without any concern about clashing with an alternative definition in a containing scope. The rule is, if it's closer, it's the one I use. Let's take a look at that. So here's an example from the old days drawn from C, which is a very old language indeed now, 70s. That's, you know, back to your parents' time or grandparents'. But let's look at how this is interpreted then. So the way that worked is we had intermixing declarations of global variables like int x and z, and the two subprograms there are really just methods. So think of them as methods, one named A and one named B. Neither of them takes parameters, but they do have local variables. And local variables can be int or float in this simple case. And how we interpret what a variable means is based on this notion of scoping. So in this case, X and Z are accessible throughout the entire body, this won't half page. But if I have a local definition, it will hide the more global definition. So X and Z are globally accessible. Void A and B are also global, but they also open the scope. And you can tell that by the fact there are braces there. Now, here's a question that you may not have ever thought about, but sometimes just by knowing how something is implemented, you can answer a question which otherwise might not be all that obvious. Namely, the names A and B, are they global or are they local? Remember, I just said a moment ago that A and B have a local scope for their definitions. Does that include the name of the method or not? Now, you say to yourself, well, I don't know. I didn't invent a darn language. Why bother me? But it turns out one of these things, there's only two choices. One choice works, and the other choice doesn't work, in which case you can be pretty sure that, you know, which choice was made. So our two choices are A and B are global, or A is local to its body and B is local to its body. Suppose we did the latter, that A is local to its body and B to it. What bad thing would happen? Nobody could call it. It's like a black hole. You know, you see all these great movies where you know, I was in Black Hole last semester, and you were too. When I saw that, I never knew whether that meant the Black Hole of science fiction fame or the Black Hole of Calcutta, which is a less pleasant place, you know, and maybe you've got too many students in here or too many employees. It could turn out to be the latter. But yeah, it turns out that that's a possible interpretation, but it doesn't work. Nobody's going to define a method because methods are called from the outside. If the name does not escape, then the method can never be used. You say, but wait a minute, notice what that's really saying is we have this odd rule. Let me write down this so I can actually tamper with it a bit. So here's the body. And change it, of course. I got to get a touch switch or something here. So we know the A is global. We know all the locals here are local. I didn't show any parameters. If I have a parameter like int I, is that local or global, would you imagine? Local. because it makes sense there, that I want this I to be accessible only when A is being executed. But notice this is kind of funny, because that means we have a funny sort of dividing line that says this method has a little bit of it that's global, namely its name itself, but the rest of it, its parameters and its internal variables, are all local. So somehow when you're implementing this, you got to flip a switch. Declaration of A is global. Declaration of int I is local. And you got to flip the switch, and you got to know exactly when to do it. So it's not obvious from the structure, but it's something from the usage of it that that's the way it's got to be done. So don't worry about that yet, but just something that I thought I'd mention because we will return to it in future. So let's go back to our example. So now we know A and B are global. People could call. That means A could call B and B could call A, you know, if we had this mutual recursion. So inside A, I have two local variables named X and Y that are floating. And now I have a generic print. So just assume print is defined externally, and it just means print, like print line a la Java. So each one at a time I see a use, I'd have to say, which X do I mean? And maybe there's more than one. Maybe there's only one definition, or it may be undefined, in which case I have to do an error message. So you look up X, and I have this thing saying what the answer was. But the rule is, check the local scope of A. Is there an X? And the answer is yes. So that X must be float. Look up Y. Is there a local definition of Y? Yes. So Y must be float. Look up Z or Z, if you know, you're of that persuasion. Look up Z or Z. And is it declared locally? The answer is no. So it can't be local. Is it declared globally? And the answer is yes. So the third parameter must be int. Notice if I go down to B, I have exactly the same call, but because I have no local definitions in B, my interpretation changes. Again, remember the fact that once I get outside of a scope, the definitions become inaccessible. So that means X and Y as floats cease to exist when I get to the point just before void B. Those guys are closed. You simply can't use it anymore. It's, you know, like going to a theater. The picture is already started. You may not enter after it started. So B, again, is global. I look up X. X has no local definition, so I say, is there a global? The answer is yes, so it's int. Y, in this particular case, hey, it's undeclared because there's no local, there's no global, and the Y inside A is inaccessible. You cannot get at something inside a method unless you're executing the method. So Y gets an error message, undeclared identifier, and Z is not declared locally, obviously, but it is declared globally, so it's an int. So again, you've probably learned this already, and I didn't want to bore you too much, but just to give you kind of a sense from the compiler point of view how that's going to be handled. So, block structured concepts. This nested visibility I just talked about, there's no access to identifiers outside their scope. So a couple of reasons why that's useful, and here's one of them that you may not have thought about. Oh, a couple of things. So nested declaration applies using the static nesting of scopes. So I can be in as many scopes as the programmer may have chosen, and it's always from innermost to outermost. So try the one I'm closest to, next, next, next. If you think of the scopes as creating symbol tables and each of them being linked together, it's simply going down the symbol tables for the innermost scope, the next, the next, the next, until you find a hit. If you don't find a hit anywhere, then it's undeclared, a la what I showed previously. But here's something that you may not have thought about, but it turns out to be immensely important when you write compilers. And that is that the automatic allocation of deallocation of locals follows from the fact that I cannot access a local from outside its scope. So here's why it's important. Suppose I have a program that has hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of methods in it. And many programs do. I mean, think of something as complex as a browser. There's all sorts of things in browsers that you may never use. Browsers have the option, for example, to change the language. So you could change your browser language from English to French or something. Turns out that it's nice if that works. One time I was doing a build and I had an installation where it chose the language for me. So I started getting error messages, and here is the funny thing. It turns out they were kind of like German, which I kind of understand, but they weren't German. And I could just understand enough of them to understand what it was saying, but it wasn't German. Can anybody guess what the thing had done for me in choosing languages? Well, it had a pop-up list, and being you know, very uniform. It was alphabetical. So can anybody think of what the first language probably begins with an A might be on that list? Afrikaans, which turns out to be a language used in South Africa. It's sort of derived from Dutch, which is kind of related to German. And settlers, the white settlers who were in South Africa like in the 1600s, so they had hundreds of years to define this language. So there was a case where I got error messages which I couldn't fix in Afrikaans, which is a language which I barely could understand the basis of. So it turns out that there are lots of methods, like the one in Afrikaans, that I would prefer not to use. But just think about all the variables and data they may have in them. And the cool thing about it is any method which you're not using, and that means out of the hundreds or thousands, you're probably at this point using only a couple, they don't have their data allocated as yet. So the fact you have a lot of methods doesn't hurt you unless the method is used. So that means unused methods. So you still have to have space for their code. But having space for their data, just imagine, might have a huge table of all the various messages that might be sent to me in Afrikaans that I wouldn't understand. So the lifetime of data objects is bound to the scope. And that means when we implement languages, when we open a scope, we'll then allocate the data. And when we close the scope, we'll deallocate the data, which means a program will use a lot less data than you might fear. Again, these days we have more memory than we used to. But still, being able to save memory is a great idea for any number of reasons. Something we haven't talked about yet, and something that scanners and symbol tables have to worry about, and this kind of flows back to languages too, both programming languages and human languages, and that's the question, is case significant? And if you kind of draw to human languages, there's sort of precedent for both directions. What I mean for that is, in many languages, most languages, I guess, that have case, and I don't know that all languages do, it's the case, it's the situation that a word means the same thing in upper or lower case. So if I write cat, oops, thank you, or in uppercase or cat in lowercase, that typically will mean the same thing. Now, it turns out there are some languages that use casing a little different. I know in German, nouns are always in capital, begin with a capital, and other articles, verbs, etc., don't. Does anybody know German well enough to know whether there's any cases where a cap in the same word in capital and lowercase coexist? I know some German, but I don't know enough to know that. Okay, so the situation, so the precedent in English is mostly that case is insignificant. But it's a situation there in many programming languages, case can be significant. For example, in C and Java, both. Case can be significant, and that means you can do some cute tricks, like I can have a local variable called limit that's all in lowercase, and I can also have something in uppercase that coexists with it. And in C, at least, for example, things in all uppercase are meant to be what? Constants. And that's a way of saying, I have a constant, it'll be all uppercase, and that's my way of saying constant, but it doesn't interfere with something in lowercase. But again, languages vary on this. And why is this significant? Well, if case is insignificant, I'm sorry, if case is significant, then things are easy. You enter the identifier exactly in its case. But notice the problem now is for users, I don't know about you, but I'm in a situation where I remember a word, I remember, it's hard to say, but internally, I kind of remember sounds rather than visualizations. And I know there's a lot of story about, do you teach people to spell phonetically? You know, cat is cat. Or do you just see the C-A-T pop up in your brain and that's what it is? I learned phonetically, so when I hear cat, you know, it's a situation there. But my little internal voice doesn't say uppercase C or lowercase C. So it turns out that cat with an uppercase and cat with lowercase both sound out the same in my brain. So it's a situation there where if you have somebody who's a user and they write limit, and later on they write L-I-M-I-T, limit is limit is limit. But if you have language where case is significant, you, at the worst, give them an error message. And why is that a particularly bad error message? Some error messages are okay. You made a mistake, they tell you you made a mistake, you fix it. Why would a mistake that would say limit is undeclared be terrible? Because it's a situation, the person is thinking, well, that's limit is that one, and it is declared. And you say, wait a minute, it's declared. And it takes a while to say, oh, wait a minute, this is one of those crazy languages where uppercase L, lowercase L make a difference. So that'd be an argument against it. Suppose you had that. How could you, just as a sidelight, frame a better error message? What you could do is you could say, let's look this guy up in a case-independent method and see if there's a cognate, L-I-M-I-T, in any mixed case. And say, uh-oh, limit is undeclared with capital L. Did you mean lowercase L? It's sort of, you know, situation like Google. One of the things I love about Google is I can't spell worth a darn, and Google never rubs my nose in it. And I kind of get lazy, as probably you do, too. It's a situation like, whenever I want to look up Marseille, which is a city in southern France, some of you can spell it, but I can't spell Marseille worth heck. So I give it my best guess and, you know, do a Google lookup and says, did you mean? And they give me the correct spelling. I said, yeah, of course I did. And away we go. So we might want to have a friendly sort of thing like that. And if case is significant, you either give an error message sometimes or you do some extra lookup and saying, yeah, there's not any limit there, but there's something close to it. And it turns out a lot of fancier systems do things like that. If you have something that's undeclared, it checks for near misses. And again, you have things that have spelling checkers. They do that, for example, where you have a word that's very close to a valid word, but you mistyped a letter or missing a letter or something like that. It catches it. So is case significant? In the case where it is significant, life is pretty easy. Particularly if you're not trying to give great error messages. You look it up as the user types it. It matches or it doesn't. But guess what? In my language, because it's my language, case is insignificant. And there are other languages, and certainly not just mine, Pascal, Ada, Scheme, and CSX, where case is not significant. I never much liked this idea. So, again, it's because I'm used to thinking words phonetically and I can't tell the sound difference between that. That in my language, double A lowercase and double A uppercase are the same identifier. If you want to type them differently, that's fine. It doesn't make a difference. It's the same word. I'm doing that partially just to make you aware of the difference and, of course, to make your life a little more miserable because now you're going to have to live with it. So how do you handle that? The standard way of doing it is to do something called stripping of case. So what stripping of case says is the user will have the identifier the way he or she specified it, but inside the table, I'll store it in a uniform case. So I may decide, for example, to have uniformly all identifiers in all lowercase. So if a user types in that, it'll be stored as limit. But if the user types in that, it'll also be stored or looked up as all lowercase. Although in the actual symbol table entry, I'll store the way the user declared it so that the user gets messages in terms of their preferred casing style. So if the user is uniform about it, fine. If they're not, well, I'll probably use the one in terms of the definition. If you defined it as uppercase L, in my error messages, I'll use it as uppercase L. But as a courtesy to you, lowercase L is considered equivalent, and away you go. So that means when you're doing your symbol table, you'll take it and strip the case. Turns out that's not very hard to do. That if you look at the string class, it's got some methods that do just that for you. It'll change the string, all the letters to uppercase or lowercase uniformly, and you just apply that method. And store it internally so that when it's hashed as all uppercase or lowercase or whatever you want. And that's a way to handle the casing being significant. I'm sorry, casing being insignificant. So that means that if I put in AAA in various forms, they're all converted uniformly for symbol table entry and lookup. And because they're done uniformly, that means there's not going to be any confusion. But again, you store it probably in the form that the user first defined it, just so the user gets the appearance of whatever form they preferred. So that's a little warning there that I have to worry about. And here's what I just said, but inside the symbol table, it's stored in the form that was declared so that programmers see the form they expect. Now you're saying, what does he mean about having these two different forms? It's not nearly as complex as you might imagine. It simply means if the user declares something like this, I hash it into the table in exactly the position that lowercase L limit would go. But inside the entry here, I say, what is the ID actually equal to? It's the uppercase limit. So it's not very different than I might hash something in English, but if I had something where the user was in Spanish mode or French mode, I would print it out in the French or Spanish version so that it was more intelligible. But internally, I would use the same basic word for uniformity across all the usages that appear. So it's not as hard as it might appear, but just be clear on that. Ooh, see what we're doing time-wise. Okay. So finally, we're getting to what you need to know. How are symbol tables implemented? And the reason we care about that is that you have to implement one. That's the bad news. The good news is that this slide I'm going to show you next is something that all the 367 people have seen before. And if you had your crib notes, you probably have this all written down from last final exam. So there are a number of data structures that can be reasonably used to implement a symbol table. An ordered list. We've all seen that, right? If you do an ordered list, you can do a binary search. That means you simply have a list of names, and they're sorted, and every time you put an entry in there, you have to resort. You've certainly seen that. Maybe not the best one, but you certainly know about it. Or I can do a binary search tree, the old BST. You certainly spend enough time worrying about that. So lookup is faster than linked list, but rebalancing may be needed. So if I rebalance, what kind of tree do I use? Anybody remember? Red-black, yeah. So you say I'm never, ever going to have to use red-black again, and hopefully not. But there's a spot where it could actually be used, and that would make the trees more balanced. Or what almost certainly you're going to use is a hash table. And it turns out Java has perfectly fine hash tables built in. So what you're going to do is each scope, and let me flip over again here now. So new scope. Simply implies new hash table. And of course, the hash table is going to be an empty table. What happens if I have nested scopes? What I do is create myself a linked list, a chain, call it what you want. So nested scopes imply a list of hash tables. And as you might imagine, because we have this rule that the innermost scope takes precedence, the list has the property, the innermost scope is the head of the list, then the next containing, the next containing, the next containing, the very last one, and possibly the only one in the list, would be globals. So all programs will have a global scope. They may not have any declarations in it. It's certainly possible to have programs like Hi Mom or Hello World. That is a valid program that has no variable declarations, no identifiers, just calls to things like print line. And the way print line works is, remember, it's imported from an outer scope. So I guess there really is sort of a scope hidden in there, but we're not going to use it. In our language, print and read are not library routines. They're reserved words. So print and read are written into the language. That's simply so that we don't have to tie libraries in too tightly. So that's basically the idea we're going to do. So you're going to have to open and close scopes. What does that mean? Well, where do you open a scope? The very first time you open a scope is top of the program. So we have a CSX light node. The very first thing you did, or the very first thing I did, remember, when I hit a CSX node is I opened the new scope, or the scope info thing. So when you hit the very first left brace, but of course, you don't see a left brace. You're seeing a tree. So that's been incorporated into the root of the tree, the CSX light node. So that gives you one new symbol table. So at the very beginning, you have one scope. Another spot that opens a scope is anytime you see another brace. And in our simple language, the only other place you see a brace is in something called a block. A block appears any place where a statement may appear. The difference is it opens the scope, allows for local definitions and statements. So every time I see a new block, I say, uh-oh, brand new scope. So what I do is I create another new symbol table, and I link the new one to the previous symbol table or symbol tables. So if I see another block down here, I create yet a new symbol table. So in this case, I'd have top of program, call this block 1, and call this block 2. So this would be the globals. This would be block 1's locals. And block 2 locals. And you can see this continues on and on. So that's building. But how do I change the symbol table when I exit a scope? That is when I hit a right brace. But of course, I don't see a right brace because it's all in tree land now. So how do I know when I'm leaving the body of a block? Say it a little louder. Well, not even simpler than that. What happens is the block is a subtree, a pair of subtrees. A block is just like the main program. It's got decals and statements. What I do is I visit the children and I return to the parents. Remember, this is a tree walk. So I say, I'm in the parent. And I say, I just walked the entire block's subtrees. I'm done. I'm never going to visit those guys again. I'm out of here on that. So what you do is when I hit here, I visited all the declarations that block 2 had and all the statements. I just walked the trees and they returned back to me. So in the block node corresponding to this guy, the one that created the symbol table, he's now going to destroy it. How can I destroy it? Well, all I need to destroy it is essentially change the link to the first symbol table back to where it was when I started. So whatever was a good symbol table when I started the block is going to be the symbol table I revert to when I go back. So now when I'm inside block 1 but not inside block 2 anymore, I have these two symbol tables. When I hit the end of this block, the symbol table goes away and all I have left is globals. And in theory, when I hit the end of the program, that is, I've walked the entire subtree of the whole program, I can throw the symbol table away, or since it's not going to be used anymore, I can just discard it and let the system cleanup do it. So like last time you use a variable, you don't necessarily need to throw it away because it's not going to be used anymore. But that's the basic idea of what we want to do. So one way of doing it, and I just mentioned that because it's in the book, this is an old-fashioned thing, is once upon a time in the ancient past, computer memory was scarce. And if I would have said this back, you know, when I was first getting into compiling, somebody put it in hand, boy, I ain't got the computer memory for that. Of course, that's no longer an issue. But what you could do is if memory were really a problem, is you could tag entries with a scope number. So you all exist inside one table, but you have different numbers, and it gets more complex. The only advantage of it is you use less memory, but it used way more brain cells, and I have more memory and less brain cells these days, so I don't want to do that. So a little bit more wasteful, but again, we're in the area, you know, of having gigabytes and terabytes of memory, is we allocate one table for each scope. The scopes are stacked. Remember, this list is really treated like a stack. So I push and pop at the one end, but things are so think of a stack as being implemented by a linked list. And oops. And we still go fine and cool. So that's all we had to do about tables. So we have a final half hour and we'll start about scanning in about 10 minutes. So about 10 of, and we'll get you out of here about 20 after. Any questions on table? I mean, at this stage, what I'm talking about now for the next part will be on project 2. So I should have covered all the material you need for project 1. Anything still bothering you? Just having to do it. That's always the hard part. And not even get paid to do it. I have you do the work and I get paid. So what a setup. Okay, we'll see you in about 10 minutes at about 7:50 and we'll have our final session.